Connecting. Access granted. It's the Chris Hood Digital Show, where global business and technology leaders meet to discuss strategy, innovation, and digital acceleration. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Your digital evolution starts now. Here's your host, Chris Hood.
Welcome to the show. Julian, would you mind introducing yourself?
Absolutely. Hello, and thank you for having me today. My name is Julian Willard. I currently serve as a leader for enterprise strategy, working with pharmaceutical clients at IBM Consulting. And IBM Consulting is a consulting arm of IBM. My journey began in ophthalmology and has taken me to the crossroads of global health, technology, data science, and health equity. I've actually been very fortunate to work in the Foreign Service and supporting Oxfam, Great Britain, World Bank, United Nations, World Economic Forum, focusing specifically on health and pharmaceutical economics and policy, and also the transformative power of data and data science driving healthcare and pharma strategies. And beyond my roles today, I also represented in 2023 the United States of America in the domain of biotechnology at World Business Angels Investment Forum. It's been a fascinating journey for me, marrying the worlds of pharma strategy and data. And today in my line of work, I'm a go-to person for senior executives in the big pharma and sometimes in smaller biotech. I'm based in Southern California. You know, it's the second largest biotech hub in the country. It's a pretty engaging role, diving deep into the heart of the industry every day and always being on the lookout for what's new or shifting. My role is typically to anticipate and shape the new trends with clients. And no idea is a crazy idea in my playbook. And my mission is to find those often overlooked opportunities in a company's strategy and give them the spotlight they deserve, guiding my pharma clients to adapt and grow. And I've had some great collaborations with top-tier pharma giants, helping align their vision and investments, leveraging both current and upcoming technologies, and also streamline their operations. And I know that you invited me to talk about big data today, and big data in life sciences can actually enable unprecedented understanding of diseases and treatment, particularly in precision medicine and precision oncology. And these data sources may include health records, medical imaging, genomic sequencing, payer claims, wearable devices, you know, glucose monitors, and the ability to combine the data sets and use data across many analyses is critical to successful use of big data. However, there are some concerns that we can talk more about.
Fabulous. It's great to have you here. I'm actually excited about this because although I don't spend a lot of time in the healthcare or pharmaceutical industries, I do have some experience working with similar companies. And I want to start with probably something that's top of mind of everyone still, and that is the pandemic that we just went through. And what I want to position is, if you look at where the industry was, say, 3 years ago, in terms of trends, strategy, data, usage of that data, before the pandemic, and then where are we today? What big differences have you seen shift through that industry?
I think the first major shift was how we think about the drug development. And as you probably remember, the vaccines were developed pretty quickly. And it was made available not because the regulatory agencies, you know, decided to be more flexible with pharma companies, but also it was an opportunity for pharma companies to leverage that very big data, right? So drug development today is a rather time-consuming and complex journey. The ROI on drug development today is at about 1.5%. So companies actually look very closely at the opportunities to be more efficient at an operational level from the manufacturing supply chain perspective, from the way they market drugs, But also, there is a huge opportunity right now to use leverage big data, multi-omics data, clinical context data to look for new therapeutics. And as we know, one of the vaccines during COVID-19 was developed using the artificial intelligence, looking at the big data set, essentially, right? And the historical research data to help design a new molecule. But also from the supply chain and manufacturing perspective, a lot of the clients that I work with, they accelerated their big data pursuits and development of artificial intelligence and machine learning techniques during that time, specifically to deliver drugs to market very quickly.
Yeah, when we talk about AI, or when I've talked about AI previously on this podcast, a lot of it is focused on business. And in most cases, people don't really understand the use cases for AI, especially when we're talking about general business. But I think pharmaceutical and research and development in the healthcare space specifically is a great example of the power of AI to dissect all of the data that we have available to us to help us accelerate the discovery of new vaccines. What I would like to dive into, though, is there's clearly a lot of different types of data. You just talked about data sets, but can you give us an understanding of what is the type of data? Like if we were just to make it generic, what is the type of data that researchers are bringing in and then targeting with the AI for this development?
So now when we talk about the big data that are used for example, drug discovery, we look at three aspects. One is breadth of data, depth of data, and diversity of data, right? From the breadth perspective, large number of individuals get us closer to underlying source population, right? There is a potential reduction in selection bias. When we talk about the depth of data, increasing amount of data on each individual increases the chance that we will have measures of likely confounders, which potentially reduces the information bias. And when we think about the diversity of data, different types of data offer us the potential to cross-check findings for any particular data source. And it's a potential to enhance control for residual bias and improve the generalizability of the data findings. So when we look at the data sets that are used, these are the data that look at the socioeconomic status, demographic status. These are the knowledge base on existing, for example, molecule designs and properties. It can be medical product exposure data, safety data, genomic data. We pay a lot of attention to the electronic health records today, which is why it is so important today to make electronic health record systems to be interoperable. As you know, that we also look now, or there is a potential to look now at the social media and marketing data to recruit patients more effectively, to understand how patients interact with the healthcare system, with the drugs, and so on and so forth.
By the way, that's exactly what I was looking for, so that's great. You touched on two things that I want to cover in here. One is interoperability. I'm going to get to that. The other one is when we start thinking about the sources of data, we get into a concept called streaming data, which is real-time data coming into the set that we are analyzing. If I'm looking at all of the different types of wearable devices, that is also increasing the bandwidth that is coming in. And to offset this conversation, I just read an article yesterday where Best Buy, which is a technology, you know, they're selling TVs and computer systems, are now interested in getting into the healthcare field. Again, specifically, I think around IoT and wearable healthcare devices. All of that data is going to impact how fast you can do research, correct?
That is correct. But also, many players now are interested in working closer with the patient population or with the community to have a closer involvement with a person's life. And now that we have medical devices, we have continuous glucose monitors that sync with our Apple Health or Android devices, you have an opportunity to build a full picture, a portrait of that person who is potentially your customer.
And that gets into the interoperability that you were talking about. Consumers, I'm a consumer. I will go and buy a medical device for my home. I will go to visit the doctor. I will want to share my information. Being able to share our medical information between different organizations and different systems, obviously there's privacy concerns, but even if I opt in and say, yes, I'm okay with sharing my glucose levels with my doctor through this technology into their system, some of that is not even in place yet.
You're right. And there is a lot of conversation around interoperability. And when we think about the data and problems associated with implementing big data approaches effectively, one of them is data quality. And, you know, the concept of data quality is most commonly defined as showing the property of data fitness, the ability to be used for its intended purpose. And it usually encompasses characteristics such as accuracy, completeness, consistency, reliability, lack of bias, and timeliness or currency of that data. So you probably heard of the term real-world data. So real-world data and the attractiveness of it, defined as data collected outside the context of a clinical trial from sources such as electronic health record systems, disease registries, you know, payer claims, wearable devices, and so on and so forth. And it's increasingly very important to start collecting that data, not just for the safety profile of the medications, but also continuously track the effectiveness of those medications in the field. One of the things that is important for the data quality is the data interoperability. And there are standards-based solutions that address both syntactic interoperability, meaning that's related to the data format and communication protocols, but also there is semantic interoperability related to the meaning of the data that's being exchanged. Let's say I'm an organization that is sharing the data with you. Field row number one is the age of a patient, right? On your end, your data set should have the field that's reflecting the age of the patient to be ready to receive the information that I'm sending to you, right? So this is called semantic interoperability. And now there are standards such as a FHIR standard, for example. There's also interesting initiatives such as M-Code. It's a Minimal Common Oncology Data Elements initiative led by the American Society of Clinical Oncology. It was basically established as a foundational data specification in which clinical oncology data elements are defined by the standards, non-proprietary terminologies, and also logical observation codes. And it made easier to do oncology research and exchange of the data between different participants in the oncology ecosystem. It sounds like it's a very basic need and table stakes today to have interoperable data, but we still don't have it in place. And it is a challenge. Sometimes, actually, one of my things that I've, in an ideal world, what if each person had a folder somewhere, in the cloud that would collect all of their information through their entire life? And as a healthcare provider, they would have access to that folder. If I change my provider, a different provider would have access to that folder, right? And as I progress in life, my folder would get thicker and thicker with my information, right? Unfortunately, this is not how this works today.
I know it's not how it works today. And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there shaking their head. Yes, I wish it did work that way. The latest example, I don't go to the doctor that often, but when I had to travel and we were in the midst of the pandemic, you had to go, you get the vaccine, you would have to get a test. I would go one place, get a test, and then I would go to another doctor to perform another checkup. And they would say, well, we have to validate that you've had a test done. And I said, I just had a test done. Can't you see it in the system? No, there's no system that tracks this type of activity. And so to me, this is very basic concepts. Wherever I go, you should have a record of, like you said, a folder of my historical information from every checkout I've ever had in my entire life should be there. It would be great. If we compare this to other industries, obviously financial and banking is going through an open banking process to build interoperability and to think about a checking account that you have. If you wanted to switch banks, that checking account should be able to go with you. They haven't quite gotten there yet. Telecom has gotten there. If you have your mobile device, you get a phone number on a phone, and if you decide to switch carriers, you can take your phone number with you to the new carrier. It's the same concept. All we ask for as consumers is that we can take our data with us wherever we go. And to your point, the desire is there. We know the desire is there, but the technology, the systems, all of the regulations, privacies, all these concerns are preventing a lot of it from happening.
Yes. And the thing is, so I, for example, moved from one country to another. Then I moved within the United States. I used to live in on the East Coast in Washington, D.C., and I recently moved to San Diego in California. In the United States, my healthcare provider, for example, is now One Medical. And I know that you can go and manually download, extract your health record. And if I decide to choose to go with another healthcare provider, I can download the record and share that record with a different provider, right? That provider will upload that record, but still, it is a lot of unstructured text, which as a primary healthcare provider where you don't have time to read the a lot of unstructured text that I just brought through my electronic health records. But today, it's primarily a manual process, and it's on you as a patient to care about carrying your health record around.
This is where I think AI can become a huge benefit for us as individuals. If I had a personal AI assistant that traveled around with me that had access to my vast medical records, and you could ask questions like, when's the last time you had a tetanus shot, as an example, and it could just go search your medical records and respond really quickly to the doctor. Now we're talking about a little bit sci-fi, but we're not far away from that. What's interesting about the AI portion, though, is it does bring in some ethical conversations in terms of how much of that data do you expose through AI to learn. What are you seeing happening within your space regarding AI and ethics?
Well, AI ethics is a big thing when it comes to collecting the data on human subjects. And when I think about AI, I usually think about five key focal areas. One area is accountability. Second area is value alignment. Third area is explainability, then fairness, and then user data rights. So just to give you an idea of what each stands for. So when we think about the accountability, every person that's involved in the creation of artificial intelligence at any step is accountable for considering the system's impact in the world or on a human subject, right? So it is very important that the company policies are very clear and accessible to design and development teams that work on AI projects from day one, so they understand what their responsibilities are with regards to AI. It's also important to keep detailed records of all of your design process and decision making as you go through the AI algorithm development process, right? You have to be able to go back and say, this is what the process was as we were going through it. The second is, you know, AI should be designed to align with the values of the organization and the society, right? It has to understand what is right and what is wrong. And for that, you need to have a culture in place within the organization that reflects that. When we talk about explainability, AI has to be designed in a way that you can go back and answer a question, how this answer was derived from the data that was provided, right? the decision-making processes must be very much reviewable, especially if the AI is working with highly sensitive personal information. And teams that work on AI projects, they should have and maintain access to a record of an AI's decision processes, right? And they should be able to verify that. When it comes to fairness, we need to implement certain tactics and techniques to minimize bias and promote inclusive representation. And for that, you need to really be looking for your diverse, for the data set to be very diverse, right? If your data set excludes, let's say, African-American population, right, or LGBT population, then in the end, your AI algorithms will be focused, will be skewed towards the population that was part of the initial data set, right, which creates an opportunity for bias. So you have to be designing and developing the AI programs without intentional biases, and you have to be monitoring this proactively. And finally, the user data rights. I think there's a lot of conversation now about patients owning their data. And I think this is something that we need to strive to achieve. And in fact, I do believe that the participant contributed clinical research is going to get more popularity as we grow in our understanding of data and AI, where patients can form communities or groups and decide proactively that they would want to contribute their data for the purposes of clinical research. And it has already been done before. For our listeners, you can search for All of Us research program. It actually has a direct volunteer pathway where patients can volunteer their data to clinical research. I think this is fascinating.
Yeah. You know, the fairness piece is interesting too, because if we think about what you were just talking about and having people volunteer or contribute to research, be open to sharing their data, in theory, we are getting diversity of data from that volunteer segment. I tend to argue that in order to create unbiased data sources, you have to anonymize that data. Now, we talk about anonymization of data in general for privacy concerns. But when we start talking about demographic type of data included, now we sort of know who individuals are, which creates fairness, but does have the potential of introducing a bias into that data. If we were to anonymize the data, thus remove that demographic element, then in theory, we are removing bias from the equation as well. I counter that in my own state, in my own case, by saying the additional data, though, the demographic data, the preferential data, all contributes to a more robust model, right? So it's interesting as you start to think about bias, especially when it comes from AI and looking at segments. Absolutely. I think it's fascinating when we can say, let's open it up. Let's get more volunteers. Let's get a wider diversity of data sources. But I guess my point is at what point in time do you leverage data for additional data points versus leveraging that data to specifically ensure fairness and diversification of data? It's a fine line. I realize it. But just tossing it out there.
So I agree with you that the diversity of the data and the data set is important. And my position is that we should collect as much data as possible from as many, let's say, human subjects as possible to make our data set truly diverse. And the ability to navigate the complexity and integrate seemingly disparate data sets to derive underappreciated insights could definitely improve the patient outcomes and increase efficiency in our healthcare system and also drive discovery of new therapeutics. However, there are approaches, and in data science, it's called the parsimonious approach to data entry, where you specifically limit your data collection to only certain parameters. It makes the research process easy. It enables to derive some insights. However, it creates a lot of bias. So the more parameters and characteristics on the data you collect from as many subjects as you possibly can, the more diverse and less biased this data collection process is going to be.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about how we have, I mean, I'm thinking about where we were from a data collection viewpoint, say 5 years ago. I mean, 10 years ago, 5 years ago to today. What some people may not realize is if we look at all of the data in the world, as of today, we're roughly at 90 zettabytes of data worldwide. In the next 2 years, that's going to double to about 180 zettabytes. And for those of you who don't know what a zettabyte is, if you were to take your mobile device, which probably has about 1 terabyte of data on it, at least my mobile device has 1 terabyte of data, in 2 years, that represents every single person in the entire world owning 20 mobile phones each. That's a lot of data. And heck, my phone isn't even at half, you know, full in terms of data on it. So across all of the different segments, not just data collected, but images and videos and metadata that is out there, you know, audio, podcasts like we're recording right now becomes data that can be dissected and understood. It's just a mass amount of data that we have available now to research, which we've never had before. Also, as a complete side note, which is also one of the reasons why I believe AI like ChatGPT has become so popular. It's the amount of data that it has access to and the accessibility that we all have to use it, which I guess is a great next question. Do we see not only us as individuals contributing to that data from a healthcare research perspective, but do you see us participating in the research itself potentially? Like, do you see us becoming individual scientists? Because, you know, I think about like the SETI program, SETI, search for extraterrestrial aliens and sounds in the universe. All we had to do was connect a bunch of computers together and we can log in and download an application and contribute to that effort. We get things like, what is it called? Folding, I think it's called, where you can actually go and help research cancer. Like, I think maybe with the use of AI, those types of research capabilities are going to become more accessible for us to participate in.
I definitely think that the technology, especially generative AI now through ChatGPT 3.5 and now 4, made AI very much accessible to everyone. But, you know, it is limited to generation of text. I do think that democratization of data and tools that enable our playing around with artificial intelligence for the public is very important. However, I think we're very far from people actually participating in research that is meaningful using these tools, right? And even if we talk about protein folding that you mentioned now, a lot of PhD scientists work on this topic every day, specifically using generative AI for new molecule design. And it's a pretty complex problem to solve. And even they are, you know, oftentimes puzzled if there is something there, right? I have had a conversation with a couple of scientists last week about this. And they're saying, yes, there is something there. But it will take us months or years to get to a meaningful advancement in this technology for the research purpose.
I love that. And it's probably a good way to end a meaningful outcome, which is what I think we're all looking for, whether it's going to the doctor and having a meaningful engagement with our doctor because the doctor knows our history, or actually getting meaningful vaccines or, you know, meaningful research. I think that is definitely a key differentiator between random research and, you know, all the data that we have access to.
I think personally, I would want to see ChatGPT or other generative AI tools to be used in a doctor's office. I would want to go to my doctor office who would type in a chat in my electronic health record system asking, were my problems in the past, whatever, 3 to 5 visits, right? However, we're getting into the topic of medical advice. And that's where it becomes risky, right? Because what if the technology summarizes my visits or my laboratory results incorrectly and presents this to a doctor with certainty? And we know the biggest problem of ChatGPT and other generative AI tools is hallucinations, right? It presents the results with so much certainty and it looks so correct that you just believe it, right? And I don't want my lab results or my past visits to be misrepresented to my doctor.
I've had conversations with others on this topic, and I present it as a basic. If you had the option to go in for a very difficult brain surgery, and you had the choice between an AI doing the brain surgery at a 99.9% accuracy, or a real doctor to do the exact same surgery at a, say, 99.5% accuracy, what would you pick? Which one would you pick? And most people actually would pick the real life doctor, because that trust factor, as you've alluded to, is not quite there. We do see hallucinations. We do see information coming across. I do not want to be prescribed medicine that would not work for me or could be even fatal to me just because the AI said, yes, you should take two of these and call me in the morning.
Well, 0.3% difference is not that huge. I would go with AI probably.
There you go. How can people get in touch with you?
If you're interested in brainstorming, you can just reach out on LinkedIn, and I'm very much approachable and look forward to the conversation.
Great. And I'll have your LinkedIn profile and other information for you on our website with this podcast. Julian, appreciate it so much. Fabulous conversation.
Thank you so much.
And of course, thanks to all of you who are listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a review. Your feedback helps us improve and grow. And if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for the show, you can connect with us throughout social media and online at Chris Hood Show. And please share this episode with your friends, family, colleagues, or anyone else looking to grow their business and start their own digital evolution. Until next week, take care and stay connected.